Game on.
Game on.
2FM.
And you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cowell with you until 8 o'clock tonight. We're going to preview the Champions League with Mark Langdon in a few minutes' time. James Craig is a former Scotland international rugby player and has had a long-standing battle with depression. We're going to talk to him a little bit later on the show. Darren O'Neill is in studio to talk boxing ahead of the Nationals this weekend. Gary Murphy is here for all things golf. We love your texts as always, 51552 or at Game On 2FM on Twitter. You're both very welcome, lads.
Thanks, Hugh.
Thanks, Hugh.
It was an interesting weekend golf-wise, and you know, the right person in terms of the season won. I think overall nobody would have had too many complaints about McIlroy taking the title in Dubai.
Not at all. It was a fabulous win. I think Andy Sullivan ran it very close.
Yeah,
and good to see Rory back. You know, back in the zone. Sullivan did really well because Rory had pretty much his A game on Sunday and just got by with a little bit of drama at the end. Hold a 40-footer on second last hole for bogey after entering the water, and it was a great win, and he won, you know, both titles, Race to Dubai and £1.7 million for the week's work.
Yeah, nice. And nice work for anyone who followed your tips as well. Rory McIlroy, who you tipped up, who won it, and Brandon Grace, who finished third. So an each way bet and a winner bet. That would have paid for a few pints over the weekend, I'd imagine.
It would, and it was good to see Graham McDowell back in action as well, following up from his win the previous weekend and finished tied third, and that's, you know, a huge end of the season for him, and really sets him up for next year, because he went back to play those events because his exemption is up at the end of this season on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I had a lot of question marks over whether he would come back at all. Such was the downturn in form, and even listening to a lot of interviews he gave during the year about how, I suppose, family life had just taken preference for him over his golf. And that's, you know, once something like that happens, it's a huge shift in your lifestyle, and sometimes you don't want to go back, let alone can go back and actually get to a standard that you were before.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all about the desire, and I think he'd undoubtedly taken his eye off the ball and tried, you know, start fiddling around with stuff, and he got back to basics, and it was a super couple of weeks, and he's now nearly back in the top 50. He's in Augusta through the win, so it's onwards and upwards for him next season.
We're going to talk more on the golf with Gary a little bit later on in the show. 51552, if you have any questions, by the way. Winter time approaching, that's the time to work on your game, I suppose. So if you have anything as an amateur that you'd just like to work on, or a bit of advice for Gary, 51552 or at Game On 2FM on Twitter. It's been a while, Darren, since we had you in.
Yeah, it's been a good while, actually.
You're looking fit for a fat bastard.
Yeah, well, the worst you know, Hugh, is pretty slim.
You're ready to go, though. You've got a quarter-final this weekend.
Yeah, quarter-final this weekend. Looking forward to it. So, for those who have been missing me, I've been training hard. Yeah, I know I've been training very hard.
Training a bit too hard. Can you just fill us in what happened? You went to the doctor recently enough.
Yeah, I suppose the advantage of having, you know, sports staff available to you, medical staff available to you. I occasionally get blood tests done because I can occasionally be low on iron or ferritin. So I went in, must be two weeks back. And the doctor said to me, one of my measures were through the roof. Basically, it was a signal that I was overtraining, but yeah, they were absolutely astronomically high. Yeah. Well, the old Google machine was telling me so as well. But look, you have faith in the doctors, and obviously he said to me, Darren, you need to take a few days off, simple as that. And I suppose, look, it was an accumulation of things. I went to America for a week of college, so for the week or two beforehand, knowing I was going to be missing a lot of training that week, I absolutely slaughtered myself. And the week back, obviously the week over there, your time zones are messing up your sleep patterns, and you're not getting the recovery that you should be getting. And obviously the week I came back, I tried to make up for a lot of it and probably worked myself a little bit too hard. But look, I took the few days off that I needed. Kind of my back seized up. Having to take the few days off, I suppose, probably a result of not being as active as I usually am. But I'm back in good fettle now. The few days off probably crowned me. It's probably ideal, probably exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been back, worked hard there for a week back, and, you know, now just tapering into the championship, and I'm looking forward to getting into the ring.
Well, as I mentioned, we're going to speak to James Craig, former Scotland international, a little bit later on the back of an article that appeared in the Scotland Herald this morning, which I just found fascinating for so many different reasons. And James has struggled with bipolar depression over the last couple of decades, really, I suppose, right throughout his rugby career. And he suffered hugely with concussions. And he believes there is a link. There's a definite link from what he's suffering now with depression and what happened to him on the rugby pitch and the amount of hits that he had to take and endure, coupled with the personality that he was as well. And I'm just very interested to kind of speak to him and find out exactly what he's found over the last few years and how he's managing it and what he believes that are lessons for guys who are playing the game at the moment. If you're in a sport where you're getting hit in the head constantly, it has to have a certain effect on the body, but equally, I imagine, it can have effect on your personality.
Yeah, it definitely can. Obviously, there's not an awful lot of research done around amateur boxing and brain injuries, per se, in the long term, but I suppose even just taking a concussion and stuff out of it, sport definitely can have a massive influence on your personality or your mood, or, you know, how you feel. Like, I know personally, coming back from the Olympic Games was a massive come down for me. I really, really struggled to reintegrate back into normal life for a good few months, to be honest with you. I suppose as athletes, we always have our seasons planned, your weeks planned, your days are nearly planned out. You know exactly what you're doing every minute of the day, and basically it revolves around sport. You know, even for me beforehand when I was working, I was working, obviously you're planning for that, but everything was planned. You're planned for work, you're planned for training, you know, you plan recovery for training and recovery, you know, so that you'd be able to continue working. But when I came back, you were kind of just, you were let loose for...
Was it a bit of a void, like a massive void in your life?
It was absolutely crazy. It was exactly that. And I suppose you always feel it to a lesser degree coming back from major championships, the Europeans, the Worlds, or, you know, even the multinations. You're away as a team for a period of time together. And as I say, everything is structured. You eat together, you train together, you know, you go to competition together, you're sporting each other. So you all have a common goal or purpose. And it's all, you know, laid out nearly like an army or whatever it is, you know. Everything
regimented training system, yeah.
Exactly like that. So when you come back and you're just let loose, you're kind of, you know, you're at ends of what am I meant to be doing? What do I do? You know, and there's only so much catching up with people you can do or relax and, you know, and then... I suppose boredom kicks in, and it's essentially that. What is my goal? What am I doing? What's my purpose? And I think for me, especially coming back from the Olympics, that was huge because, you know, I think I've said to you before, I wanted to win a major medal. I had done that. I wanted to be an Olympian. I had done that. So what the hell do I do now? You know, and I struggle. And, you know, I've spoke to you before and said 2013, 2014, I kind of struggle. Will I give up the sport? What am I going to do? I needed a goal. I need to refocus. And have something to aim for, and I think that's a massive area that's going to affect a lot of athletes coming out of sport, is the transition into real life. And well, I don't mean, obviously sport is real life as well, but into a normal life, and, you know, an everyday life.
You've gone through it.
Yeah, it's a curious dynamic, really. You go from being in this bubble, and then you're out of the bubble. But whilst you're out of the bubble, you still feel like you're in the bubble. And it's very hard to adapt. I really stopped playing full-time probably the end of 2012. But realistically, I didn't play a whole lot in 2012. And I hadn't expected my career to end as abruptly as it did. And I didn't really have a plan in place as such. I was a guy who never really struggled with injuries, so that wasn't going to be something to go... to worry about, and I just kind of lost my game. I wouldn't say overnight, but it was a short gradual experience, and there's no support system there in place at all. But my feeling on it is the support systems, and I've spoken to Niall O'Toole on this, and Niall is a great guy, and he's involved in doing some really good work for guys like me. But I think the most important factor is the athletes and sports people and sports women, they have to be looked after whilst they're involved in their sport.
Okay.
Not have a graveyard system of, we'll help you now.
Because it might be too late by then.
Yeah, well, they need to be proactive, because what happens as well is you feed and buy into the sport being more important than it actually is. It undoubtedly is. It forms you, it shapes you whilst you're at it. But part of that reason... is the reason that hinders a lot of sports people as well, because there's too much emphasis on the given sport and it's impossible at times to switch off. And as Darren would say, he's in an environment, he's with kind of 15 or 20 lads or girls all doing the same thing, and then you come home and conversation is undoubtedly an issue because there's that connection that you have with those people and stuff happens easily, and then you come home and people think you're prima donnas or you're this and you're that. More often than not, you're
not still struggling to connect.
You're struggling to
outside
connect
of what you're familiar with,
because you have to. And this is why I always only ever judge sports people as sport, as you know. You say Tiger Woods, he's an amazing golfer. Just leave it at that. What he's done off the course is an irrelevance. Just judge sports people for what they do. But so often, and especially like the Irish people want that connect, possibly more than other nations, and judge people, you know, like say Roy Keane, if he doesn't say hello to you, that he's an arsehole or whatever.
Mm.
You know, or things like that. Just judge sports people, because that's all they are. But it's very difficult when you come back out. And it's almost like being in jail, really. You're in jail for that period of your career. And you have to adapt to society again, because you live in a bubble.
It's a form of institutionalization then. It's
like in my biggest year on tour, I was away for 37 weeks.
Mm.
Like, that's not normal to do that. So you can't come back home and go down the pub and say, "Howdy, lads," and do normal things. So it does take time to adapt, but the learning has to be whilst you're that sports person, not fall off the cliff and we'll pick you up. And I think that's an important factor.
Yeah, there needs
for me
to be outlets there, I think. You
totally,
know?
Yeah.
Something that I'm trying to say to younger lads on the team coming through, boxing in particular is a short-lived career, as are most sports.
Mm-hmm.
They're a short-lived career, and unfortunately, within amateur boxing setup, a lot of the guys are coming through without an education, without something to fall back on. And, you know, it is difficult enough to step away from something that you've been involved in for most of your life. And then to step away from it and not have anything to fall back on is absolutely crushing. I mean,
crazy.
You know, I'm lucky enough that I have a degree behind me, and please God, in the next few months, I'll have a master's behind me. But I've been trying to tell the young lads coming through, you know, and it's maybe something that the different organisations need to look at, or, you know, someone, the government maybe even needs to look at, but there needs to be stuff put in place so that these athletes coming through and transition out of sport have something to fall back on. You know, I think you see with the rugby, they now have to be involved in something for professional development and personal development. And I think this is something that needs to be there, because there needs to be other outlets. And look, some athletes, they need to be solely focused on what they're doing, and fair enough, that's the way they're built. But I benefit performance wise when I have external distractions as well.
Yeah.
But why not have those distractions as something that can, I suppose, benefit your career after you finish?
We're going to come back to this, obviously, as I mentioned, because, you know, James Craig is going to be on later on, and I want to speak to him and then get the thoughts of the two guys as well, just to put it into context with their own experiences. 51552, if you've anything to add between now and 8 o'clock. But I want to move on, because time is against us and Mark Langdon is waiting patiently on the line, football editor with the Racing Post. Hiya, Mark.
Hi, are you okay?
Not too bad, thanks. Yeah, before we get into tonight's games, I have to ask you your thoughts on Rafael Benitez and what happened at the Bernabeu on Saturday night, because, you know, we spoke about it briefly last night. It does seem like the vote of confidence is going to do little to assuage the anger that is around Madrid at the moment and the performance of the team, and specifically been directed at Benitez.
Yeah, I mean, the manager is always going to get it in the neck at Real Madrid if they lose 4-0 to Barcelona. He's not the only one. The president, you know, also come under fire. I think really it was so surprising to see a Benitez team lacking, you know, structure, defensive organisation, you know, just stuff that you so usually associated with a Benitez team. That just completely went out of the window. I think he went against his better judgment, not playing the defensive midfielder, Casemiro, who I think is a sort of Benitez-type player. He tried to fit in all of the, you know, the superstars in there instead, and they were ripped apart, and it was just chaotic, really, that the way that the sort of second half particularly unfolded, or even before that, really, once he got to even when the first goal went in, actually, from that moment onwards, Real Madrid very rarely looked like getting back in the game. They had a little spell at 2-0, I suppose. But and it was all done, of course, with Messi only as a substitute who came on. So, yeah, the pressure's definitely on Benitez, no doubt about that one. And I think it will just continue to grow, really, because he's going to need to win a big game, if you like. But they haven't actually got sort of, you know, a real big one coming up. So it's going to be on him for a while yet. And, you know, I think it just goes to show what a good job Ancelotti did previously, because it was such a calm place when he was manager, and it seems to you know, fallen apart a little bit since he left.
I mean, his image, from what I'm reading and what I gather, doesn't fit in, you know, just Benitez as a person, and it's very fickle, really, if you want to look at it this way. But to the supporters, he's this kind of a little bit slovenly, a little bit unkempt, if you like. Doesn't fit the traditional mold of smooth, good-looking, tidy managers that have been down the years. Then he goes, and the suggestion is that he's picked a team to please the president at the weekend, which is, again, just taking on from what you just said there, with no defensive midfielder. And you kind of wonder, is he a little bit lost there at the moment? Is he trying to please too many people and, as a result, pleasing nobody?
I think there is a little bit of that, yeah. And, of course, this is his absolute dream job. This was, you know, what he kind of feels like he was born to do. So, to have it, it hasn't completely fallen apart yet. Of course, we're still early days in the season, and we could be sort of discussing this again in May, and he wins the Champions League, and everybody says, "Oh, good old Rafa, he's done it again." But I definitely think that he needs to he can only be himself, I think, and that could mean maybe dropping one or two of these players to kind of accommodate the style of football that he wants to play, because I don't think there's any point employing Rafa Benitez and then just asking him, to just go and play all of these superstars, because it's not really what he does. He's much more about the team and the team collective, and there has to be this balance between attack and defence, and it's frustrated some fans of the clubs that he's been at previously as well, and it's not always worked out for him. I mean, he was a disaster really at Inter, Napoli by the end there, it hadn't worked out. So he's had a couple of jobs really where he's been questioned, his methods have been questioned, and I think that's more to do with it. People looked at Napoli and Inter and questioned whether he was actually good enough for Real Madrid.
Yeah, and I read a piece by Kevin Palmer this morning in The Independent here, Mark, and he was very critical of Benitez, and he said, more or less suggested, this guy is a spoofer, that actually his track record is abysmal, he doesn't deserve the job at Real Madrid, and it's no wonder to him that actually he's failing at it. As you say, it's a little bit early to judge him totally on that. Would you go along with that actually Benitez has overachieved at Liverpool and everywhere else that he's gone? Actually, the reflection of his failures is actually more of a real reflection on him as a manager.
I mean, he took Liverpool to two Champions League finals, of course winning one of them. They were so close to winning the league, in which I thought was a very strong, era. He was up against Ferguson, and I think Arsenal were probably better than they are now, and he nearly sort of took Liverpool to a league title. Even at Chelsea, I thought he did a good job there, but there's no doubt in Italy, he was definitely, he was mocked almost, really, because of how bad he was at Inter, and it wasn't easy replacing Jose Mourinho, just won a treble with an ageing squad, so maybe he'll feel he wasn't given the time. At Napoli, I don't think he did a good job at Napoli, and some people feel that that's a little bit harsh, but I think you've seen this season, Napoli are playing much better football, they're better defensively, and it's basically the same set of players. So I think he was lucky to get the Real Madrid job, and I don't think Ancelotti should have been sacked. Ancelotti just he just fell a little bit short last season, but it was very difficult because Barcelona were brilliant and only one team can win, and that they were close in a lot of the competitions, and of course it wasn't that long ago he'd won the Champions League, and I think that maybe that they'll wish they hadn't got rid of Ancelotti. I think that's fair to say.
Okay, well, I'll talk to Kevin, on he's a regular on Friday nights on the show, and put that to him later on. Big game for Arsenal tonight. I think I've said this to you a couple of times before, Mark, but this really is a must-win game.
This one is must-win now. I mean, Dynamo Zagreb, I can't believe that Arsenal lost the first game to them, really. They're second in Croatia. They picked a very defensive team for tonight's game. Enriquez, usually sort of their main source of goals, he's on the bench. His strike partner, Odsic, is injured. So it looks like, from what UEFA has sort of put out on their website, as if a midfielder, Rog, will actually play up front. He hasn't scored a goal in the league this season. So I think it's going to be a very defensive performance, and Arsenal may need to be patient, but there's such a big gulf in quality between the two teams. I can't see Lightning striking twice and we get another upset. This should be a very comfortable home win.
No danger that the Real, and it was a slip up, I mean, just when you thought Arsenal looked to go and surge to the top of the table with West Brom coming, that they go and mess it up, really. No danger that's going to be a bit of a hangover tonight?
I don't think so. No, I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, obviously, okay, missing the penalty late on was a bit of a blow there. But, you know, they only conceded one shot on target to West Brom. And I think the result was a little bit unlucky, really, that they got turned over at the Hawthorns.
OK, Chelsea have to go to Maccabi Tel Aviv tonight. They've just been handed the team. So Begovic and goals, Fabregas, Raman, Oscar, Hazard, Costa, Matic, Willian, Cahill, Terry and Azpilicueta as well. Strong enough team. Chelsea, again, you know, you'd imagine, despite the fact that they're away, would you be comfortable enough that they will get the win, despite after winning at the weekend against Norwich as well?
Yeah, I mean, Maccabi are they're top in Israel and they won the treble last season, but there's such a huge gulf between playing domestically in Israel and, you know, this level of competition. They've been completely outclassed so far, so I would imagine so, yeah, that this should be comfortable. I mean, their only goal in the group stage came from a penalty, and I was just having a look at the stats earlier on. In three of their four games, the most shots on target they've managed is one shot. So I would imagine that Chelsea, you know, this should be a routine sort of about as easy as you can get really away from home in the Champions League.
Listen, I know you're pretty astute when it comes to the tips, Mark, and I ventured last night that Leicester City at still 11-1 wasn't bad value to make the top four by the end of the season, and I was laughed at by Eamon Dunphy and Alan Cawley. Is that ridiculous? Is 11-1 a reasonable bet, do you think, for Leicester to finish top four?
I'm not going to laugh, but I don't think that it will happen. I mean, they've got a lot of hard games coming up. I don't want to sort of completely rip apart what they've done so far, but I think the fixture list has been relatively kind. And if you look at what they've got to come, starting with Manchester United, it gets a lot harder over the next month or so.
Mark, just a quick one. Do you think Leicester might actually spend heavily in January and have a go at it?
I think that they've got the potential to do that. Yeah, the owners have, you know, backed both Pearson and Ranieri in the transfer market. The harder thing for them was attracting you know, quality players to the club, because you know, it's considered only Leicester. But I think, you know, if they are sort of around about, I'm not saying top, but even if they're top four, they've got the potential to certainly go again in January, because somebody like Gökhan Inle didn't want to go to Leicester in the summer. It took a lot of persuading to actually move there, because it, you know, it's just not an attractive club. Obviously, what they've done so far this season will make it slightly more attractive in the summer than what it was in the summer, and they can definitely afford the wages as well as the transfer fees. I still feel, though, that, you know, with this, all the usual suspects will finish above them.
And God help them if Vardy is snapped up by someone else in January, or if he gets injured, because, I mean, he's just an incredible run at the moment. Mark, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks, man. Enjoy the games tonight.
Thank you.
Mark Langdon there. You can read his stuff in the Racing Post, and yeah, he's too polite to laugh at me, but I think he wanted to.
We can laugh.
You guys can laugh, exactly. We've had an interesting text in from Eilish O'Leary, who's the programme director in Griffith College, and she said, on the topic of transition management, Griffith College recently launched a programme, Certificate in Dual Career Development for Sports, especially for high-performance professional athletes, and currently has six professional sports people undertaking the programme. It's QQI validated, and it is hoped that this will be the starting point of educating sports people during their career to prepare for post-sport life. So thanks a million for that, Eilish. Obviously, if anyone wants to get in touch, Griffith College, griffithcollege.com or .ie, I think is the website. I did spend 1 year there, but I drank and played pool for most of it. And
never
came
into Boxing Stadium right next door. That's terrible. But yeah, that programme has been put in place this year for the first time, so it's great. It's been in unison with Griffith College in unison with the Irish Sports Council, or the Institute of Sport, or now Sport Ireland, as they should probably call it, have put that together, and there are some athletes taking part in it. And, you know, it's definitely something that is a first step anyway, and hopefully can be carried into the future.
Griffith.ie is the website, if you want to go on and check that out. Thanks for the text. Okay, 51552. Let's just do golf now. We'll take a break after that, before we talk to James, because, you know, look, overall, it's been a pretty interesting season, Gary, and we'll talk about it again in the next kind of few weeks, because things kind of come to a slowdown, if you like. But, you know, if you had said to me at the top of the year that we were going to have three young guys contesting for the world number one position, each exciting in their own right, and the results that we've had and the performances of golf that we've seen over the last, from Jason Day, from Jordan Spieth, and from Rory, I'd say brilliant. Golf has actually never been in a better place.
It never has. And as I've said previously, that, you know, we needed at least two guys to replace Tiger. At this point last year, Jordan Spieth went to Australia, having finished third in Japan, or maybe second. I think Matsuyama beat him. But he was going down to play the Australian Open when Rory was a star billing. He was 12th in the world. And the gap now between 1, 2, 3, the gap to 4 is the same as the gap from 4 to 18, I think, the world rankings.
Which is Bubba.
Yeah, so there's a huge gap. They've separated themselves. So he's won the Australian Open, and then he flies, you know, from Sydney to Florida, which is a big trip, tees it up in Tiger's event and wins it by 10. You know, and the rest is history. He's been astonishing this year, and he's far and away my favourite player at the moment. Not because he does, you know, he doesn't play golf like Rory does, because he's not able to. I mean, when Rory's in full flow, he's pretty unbeatable. But Spieth has this dynamic about him, this ability to adapt and to learn, and just gets the ball around the course so well. And then you have Jason Day, had a remarkable second half to the season, and really going into 2016, it's very exciting. If those three guys can stay at that level, and Fowler had a good end to the year, and there's also, you know, some young, exciting talent emerging. Justin Thomas won in Malaysia. And, you know, golf is in a good place at the moment.
Is Jordan, does he represent to you the ability, as you said, to educate as a golfer, to learn, to not be the most talented, to not hit the ball the furthest and be, you know, this godsend swing that everybody can admire, but he is a credit to hard work, to perseverance, and above all, this word golfing intelligence, this phrase golfing intelligence, that seems to be, hold him in such high stead. I mean, he just, watching him play, as Shane Lowry said, there's nothing about him that I would say, oh my God, he's brilliant, but yet he is the best player on the planet at the moment.
There's this thing that, you know, which happens in a lot of sports. I think golf, you know, with early specialisation. So you get the kids in and you program them and teach them and to become champions or whatnot. I think golf is too hard a sport. It's too demanding. The variances are huge on it. And the variables change the whole time. Spieth got to 15, 16 years of age before he actually decided. So he played all the other sports. And he has a balance to his mindset, I think, because of that. But he has this innate desire to shoot the lowest score possible. And now that sounds stupid to say, because that's what people want to do the whole time. But so often in golf, and especially at the professional level, it's no different to the amateur level, you throw away shots, you lose focus, you get annoyed, you try challenge yourself and whatnot. He's the best in the world by far at not falling into that trap. And that's why you have a mix of talent. You have McIlroy, who's this amazing, you know, when the midwife slapped his arse, he had this swing and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Bannon's done a wonderful job. There's no denying that, but he has an incredible ability to hit the golf ball like no other. But sometimes that doesn't just get the job done. So I think those two next year will be brilliant. You know, and Jason Day, he's off now. His wife had a baby, little girl, a couple of days ago, and he's got that great balance then of the family life. And so it's a really interesting dynamic between the three guys, and it's been remarkable to see the standard, you know, from where Rory left it at the end of last year, and the guys have raised the bar, and then Rory wins on Sunday in some style, and everyone's now thinking, and you know, they're going to face off at the HSBC in Abu Dhabi at the end of January. Spieth's going to play and Rory, and you know, Rory has really good record around there, and it'll be curious to see.
You can tell from listening to Shane Lowry already that he really wants to make the Ryder Cup team, really wants to make it. He's been included in the Eurasia Cup lineup, Darren Clark's team.
Yeah.
And I suppose that'll give him a bit of a flavour of, you know, the team atmosphere and whatnot, obviously playing under Darren as well. He's definitely good enough. There's no reason that you can see, is there, why he wouldn't make the team?
No, absolutely not. I mean, he's the fifth highest ranked European in the world. And disappointing end to the season, but overall finished fifth in the Order of Merit. Fabulous season, and I'm sure he'll be going to get going early next year and try get, you know, because you want to try get it done as quickly as possible and not fall into the trap of, you know, looking around you too much, and then it affects your game. So
we've had a text from Tony in Galway, who is a golfer, and says, are you effing serious talking about golf, an elite sport played by the tops every night? How about weightlifting, rowing, sailing, gymnastics? Lads, time to broaden your horizons. Well, we speak about it generally of a Tuesday and of a Thursday, unless something extraordinary happens. We have a boxer here sitting beside the golfer. We are talking to an Olympic diver tomorrow. We have...
Well, he's saying there golf is an elitist sport, and he's talking about rowing and sailing. Like, seriously, Tony.
Yes, I'd like to get into sailing. How much would that cost me? Oh, just the cool $500,000 to buy your own boat. Come back to me when you have one. Have you ever been to the George Yacht Club in Dunleary, Tony?
We talk about golf.
Can't get in without a suit.
Boxing, because they're two of the most successful sports in Ireland.
Correct. I think Tony's a little bit tongue-in-cheek.
A little bit.
But thanks. 51552 at GameOn2FM on Twitter. Okay, we're going to take a break because we're going to talk to James Craig about living with bipolar after these.
Get your game face on.
Game on 2FM.
And you're very welcome back. Now, those of you that know your rugby might remember James Craig lining out for Scotland a few years back, between 1997 and 2001 to be exact. He has long since retired from the game, but was at one stage considered one of the brightest talents to emerge in Scottish rugby. But after his career finished, James has had to deal with a lot of personal issues regarding his health. I'm delighted to say he joins us on the line now. James, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much. Nice to meet you.
It's great to have you on, I must say. I mean, I was flicking through a few stories this morning, as I normally do, preparing for the show, and I did come across the article with Kevin Ferry in the Scotland Herald and the interview that you did. And I have to say, I found it very, very interesting and also quite shocking as well, if I'm being honest. How long would you say that you've struggled with depression, James?
Probably since in the article I'd said, obviously the first hallucination was 99, but depression had started just before that, probably about a year or so before that. So it's been almost 20 years now that I've been suffering from it.
And would you say, I mean, I know going through some stories from your childhood as well, that you were actually quite a shy guy and a reserved guy in what was quite a male, obviously dominated sport, quite a macho sport as well.
That's right.
How did you find growing up and playing in a sport like that, being the person that you were?
I have always been kind of a quieter person, but no, I mean, growing up in that sort of sport, there is a kind of macho environment, you know, so generally something like that, or, you know, I didn't feel ever comfortable speaking up about, you know, being depressed or, you know, it's just not something you kind of bring up in that kind of environment. Well, it felt to me at that time, you know.
Mm, it must have been difficult then. I mean, was there even guys on the team that you could talk to, or a coach, or anyone at all in the game itself?
Well, I had obviously friends on the team, but, you know, to go to them and kind of talk to them about depression and the likes, you know, it's just not something that I was willing to do. We didn't really have any psychologists or anything like that working with us at those times, you know, so there was no one really to reach out to.
Yeah.
It's also got that kind of macho stigma that, you know, that probably I was suffering from as well. You didn't want to actually reach out to anybody and kind of put it to the back of your mind, if you know, as difficult as it was, and kind of get on with life.
So how did you get into rugby? I mean, obviously your dad, Jim, is a former European Cup winner with Celtic. So was rugby the first love for you, or how did it happen?
Well, we all played football. I've got three brothers, and we all played football when we were very young. But I think my dad kind of saw the possible stigma of, you know, him having won European Cup and, you know, always been kind of related to him. We played football. So it was one Sunday, I think I must have been 8 at the time, he took us down to the local rugby club and we started to play mini rugby, you know. To our disgust, I must add.
And what was it? I mean, you were quick, obviously. So was that the main kind of attribute that you found early on?
Yeah, I mean, I was quite fast back then, but the kind of speediness came, the real kind of speed came, and I think I was about 16, fourth year at school it was, when I started to get, you know, I suddenly noticed myself, because I was a cross-country runner up until then. That was my kind of the main strength. I suddenly, you know, started to shift and suddenly got a lot quicker the older I got.
Because rugby is a game, I played it as a kid as well, and I suppose when you're kind of 7, 8, 9, 10, all the way up to a certain age, it's just, you play it because of the enjoyment of it. But the macho That's stuff right. doesn't really come into it until, I suppose, you start to hit puberty and guys are developing at different stages, and then it just takes on maybe a different shift, a different dynamic, if you like.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, you get that kind of attitude in rugby of get on with it, you know. You also get the players themselves that, you know, and as I say, I get caught up in that, the kind of macho bit where you know, you have been injured or you have been hit in the head and you don't want to admit it, you know. You want to just carry on and He's also the other aspect of rugby. You've got the when I played anyway, I know it's different now, but they had a 3-week layoff if you did get a head injury, you know. So yeah, it is a kind of macho game.
So what about the knocks to the head then? I mean, in terms of the injuries that you would have sustained, did you notice that over a build-up of time that things were getting worse, that you were getting hit harder, that you were actually, you weren't responding to them as you should? How did it all develop?
Yeah, well, obviously I played out wide in the wing, so the hits coming from that position were pretty fierce, you know, because it's not a case of where you're kind of closer in, you've got a smaller kind of range to hit somebody, you know. It's the players are coming in hard at each other. So I probably had, a conservative estimate, I had about 15 head injuries. I had two really bad ones, one in 1996 and then another in 1999, where I'd been hit in the head after but stupidly put my head on the wrong side of a tackle. And I actually came round before the medical team got to me, so I was able to play on. It's a bit of a myth, you know, you get that kind of myth where you don't know where you are, you know. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes you're okay and you get up and play on, you know.
And that second particularly bad hit coincided when you say that you began to realise that actually something wasn't right. It was more than just a couple of bad tackles, if you like.
Yeah, it did. I mean, that was the year that I started to have hallucinations. Just one day I was reversing out from my car park where I had a flat, and there was somebody standing behind the car. And as I got out to approach them to see what they were doing, there was nobody there. And from that point onwards, I'd started to suffer from hallucinations. In silence, I must add, you know, which was also quite tough. Well, it was very tough.
How frequent are we talking about here?
You're talking, it depends on what kind of period I was going through, depression or mania. Mania would be quite aggressive and you would have a few a day. Depression tends to be a little bit less, where you might have one every few days. Just depends on what kind of state you're in. Then you get your kind of normal period as well, where they'll filter right down. You still get them, but they're maybe once every couple of weeks or not.
And that particular hallucination that you've just mentioned, that was that the most frequent, that you would see the same person over and over again?
Yeah, I still see that same person up to this day.
Really?
Yeah, he doesn't see anything. It's quite a strange one, but I suppose I've kind of got used to it over the years, you know.
And when this is all starting, I mean, you're not talking to anybody about this, you're just, it's all to yourself, and you're just thinking, are you thinking, am I going crazy here? What's going on?
Well, I did. I mean, I did actually speak to somebody when it first happened. I'll not say their name, but I kind of got ridiculed. I did get ridiculed about it. So, I kind of thought, yeah, this is better kept to myself, you know. So, it's difficult when you are suffering in silence. And I think that's why I decided that the best course of action would be, you know, to help those as well that might be in the same situation as me, would to come forward and, you know, just be truthful about what's been going on.
Was the person that you reached out to, was that a teammate?
No, it wasn't a teammate. It was a friend.
And how did you feel after that reaction? I imagine, you know, as you say, you struggle to tell anybody. You reach out to one person and you get that reaction. That must have been horrendous.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was kind of taken aback, and I kind of brushed it off, I suppose, at the time as well. And, you know, I didn't know what to think. I mean, I thought, to be honest with you, at that point, when you have your first one, you think you're seeing ghosts, you know. And then it's not until further on you suddenly realise, well, you know, there's something going on here, you know.
So what kind of effect did that have on you, having to keep this to yourself? These hallucinations are ongoing, and you're obviously trying to live your life. You're trying to play sport, I presume, you know, hold down some sort of a job at the same time. So how did that affect you?
You feel trapped. I mean, it's not a nice feeling at all. And ever since I have come forward and, you know, and spoken up about it, it's you kind of get a weight lifts off your shoulders, you know. That's probably the best way I can describe it, is being trapped. You know, it's like being, you just keeping things to yourself. It just doesn't help you at all. It actually aggravates the condition. It makes it worse.
So when did you go and actually go and get proper help and say, like, I need to do something about this?
Well, that was back in April of 2014. It was a tearful plea from my wife to go to the doctor. And, you know, I was that macho thing kicked in again, you know. I don't want to go to the doctor to talk about this sort of thing, you know. But I did go, and I think it is the most nervous I've ever been in a doctor's surgery. I can't say I've ever been nervous in a doctor's surgery, actually, but I felt nervous at that point, kind of apprehensive and worried about being laughed at again if I said that, you know. But he was fantastic, the doctor.
Was there a catalyst? Was there something that happened at home with your wife that actually just kind of forced her to say, look, enough is enough here? Had things been happening in the relationship, or had she noticed a lot of things?
I was going through a bad period of depression. Mm-hmm. And when you have that sort of thing, when you have depression, it will impact on the person that you're close to. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of the not smiling and the, you know, just kind of feeling kind of down all the time. And it does have an impact on that, the other person that's close to you, you know. So, but that wasn't the first time it happened, obviously. It happened a few times before. And it was her plea, tearful plea, to go and see the doctor that got me moving, you know. And since then, she's been really kind of a rock to me, you know, something I can turn to when things aren't going very well.
I know you said you still get the hallucinations, but how are you now since that time in April 2014 when you actually went? I mean, do you feel there has been a big improvement?
Yeah, there has been an improvement. I take medication. So I started taking medication at that point, and there was an improvement in the depression side. Unfortunately, back in February of this year, I had a major manic episode that suddenly hit me one day at work.
What happened, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I just I'd already been, over the period, a few days before that, I'd started to feel the kind of build-up of energy. And I just was sitting in the office one day, and it started to ramp itself up. And the best way to describe it is it's like being wired to a mains, you know. You just got all this excessive energy flowing throughout your body, and you basically can't handle it. And I got up and had to leave the office. And I pretty much stumbled away along the street to my car, and managed to, you know, eventually kind of calm myself down.
Are there techniques that you've learned now, just you can recognise when that happens, as you said, feelings like that, and then how to deal with it?
Yeah, I mean, I recognise that happens now. I can feel it coming on now, and I do a lot of mindfulness, so that helps to nip things in the butt if they are kind of building. Doesn't stop it entirely, but through practicing mindfulness and meditation, it helps me stay in control of things. It's a very handy tool.
As far as you're concerned, James, is there a link between the hits that you would have taken, the concussions you would have suffered, and the depression that you've been going through over the last few years?
Yes, I believe there is. I took so many hits in the head that I don't think it could be caused by anything else. I believe that rugby, the continuous head knocks, has caused this condition.
And it's something that obviously World Rugby now have really kind of taken a hold of, mm-hmm. in terms of the protocols that they put in and the awareness that they are distributing to all teams and players of all ages, that this is something now that everybody needs to be so mindful of. We have had countless interviews with former professionals, current internationals, yeah. who would say the same thing, that, you know, it seems to be the approach is getting better. I mean, is that something you have experience of, or are you just watching from the sidelines now?
I'm watching more from the sidelines now, but I think it was kind of evident in this World Cup that things are getting better. You had the likes of Dan Biggar was pulled off against the last game. I can't remember who it was. Australia he was pulled off against.
Dan Biggar, in the South Africa match, I think. South Africa in the quarterfinals.
Yeah. And he was pulled off because he was obviously, he'd had a hit, and he obviously argued all the way off, but they'd obviously seen that in video and pulled him off. And then you had the bad one with Matt Gittle, you know, his was a bad one. He was pulled off, although he looked okay when he was walking off, but from the video footage you could see that it was a bad hit.
You still obviously watch rugby and you like rugby as a sport?
Yeah, I still watch it. I still like it. I loved playing, you know. I loved playing the game. If I was to go back and do it again, I would be a lot more careful, a lot more honest about the hits I would have taken. But I don't know, the time that I played, if the kind of I know now they do a lot of cognitive tests and the likes, but we didn't really have that back then, you know.
Can you just accept then that was the culture at the time, and that it was just, you know, it was a mindset really among every team out there that was the way it was done, that, you know, people just didn't speak up? Can you accept that was just the case, or are you angry actually that you didn't get the help that you needed when you needed it?
I'm not angry at all, no, but I do believe that the help we got, it could have been handled better, I think. But angry, no, not angry at all.
Okay. James, I have to say, look, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for being so honest and open with us on the show tonight. I really appreciate it.
No problem, that's great. Thanks.
Thanks a million. Cheers, James. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
James Craig there. Yeah, interesting stuff. You see, you don't... Maybe this goes back to what we were talking about last night, and I know you heard some of the show last night, and myself and Alan and Connor have been talking about, yeah, I suppose, brawls and violence in sport, and whether we make too big a deal of some or not enough is made of others. And when you hear someone like James there, Gary, and what he's been through because he wasn't looked after and he had no one to speak to, I mean, it's the impact it's had on his life. And, you know, you can read that article on the Scottish Herald website. It's impacted every part of his life.
It's probably said destroyed his life, really. Mm-hmm. And if there is a link to be determined, but if there is a link between sport and that, it's pretty sad and pretty frightening. But I think where we stand now compared to his era, I think we're a lot better prepared for that.
Yeah.
But still, it's a very sad story, and I think the big thing to get from it, especially in rugby, and, you know, a real tough, honest sport, if you are injured and hurt, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
You know, it's not a sign of weakness to go down and say, you know, I can't play, that's fine. And I think that's a big message that needs to, you know, because there is that macho thing, you keep going or you're windy or whatnot. I think that's an important factor. Plus, you know, the protection is greater nowadays, but it's a very sad story.
I think it's definitely coming, I suppose, more relevant these days. Obviously it's always relevant, but it's more, people are more aware of it.
What you're doing specifically, I mean, you look at the professional boxing casualty list over the years, and I'm not talking about necessarily just guys who've died, because obviously we know that there have been deaths from it, but I'm talking about serious brain damage from boxers. And actually, when they are gone from that ring and when they are gone from the limelight, they fade off into insignificance, and very, very few are actually followed up and looked after.
Yeah, no, that's definitely something that needs to be addressed. But I think in recent years, as Gary said, we're getting an awful lot better. I mean, look, I'm on the national senior team for God knows how long, and too long. But in the last 3 or 4 years, we have been doing these cognitive tests, or maybe a little bit longer now. But I know at the start, I wouldn't have done those.
Mm.
You know, and it was as he referred to there, you took a serious shot, that was it, you're out for 3 weeks, or 28, 29 days, 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And that was it, regardless. But I think, especially an amateur, we're very aware of it, or we try to be anyway. I know I was once, my first senior fight ever actually was an international, I didn't even box a national fight first, and it was against Wales. And I won the fight, I didn't get a count or anything, but it was a heavy blown fight, and the boy said to me after, you're going to take 2 or 3 weeks off sparring now, just to make sure that you're okay. And, you know, as I say, I wasn't concussed. I hadn't been given a count, nothing, but just because it was such a heavy blowing fight, they said, you know what, your first time up senior, we're going to give you 2 or 3 weeks off sparring. And I think they are being very aware of that. I know in the last year, there's been one or two cases again where the guys have stepped back from sparring for a few weeks, just to make sure that everything's okay. And because we've seen cases where someone goes back too early and they get knocked out again very quickly, and that can lead to further, you know, as they say in boxing terms, you get chinny, as they say, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's just... I suppose the repetitiveness of getting concussed or as they say, having heavy blows to the head is not good for you. So it needs to be addressed. It needs to be dealt with properly and carefully. You know, and you can't go back before you're ready. It's as simple as that.
Mm.
Now, I think amateur is an awful lot safer than professional, as we discussed before. In a sense, it's shorter. So I think in a professional game, as people start getting more dehydrated, the fluid from the vital organs is missing around, you know, surround them as a protection is
sure.
missing. So as they start taking heavier punches in later rounds with lighter gloves, it's obviously going to have more of an effect on your body, but we're still very conscious of it.
Well that's the thing with some of the referees. I mean, they're there to protect the fighters. You know, sometimes we want to see lads getting bludgeoned and knocked out, but the job is to protect them. I mean, Ronda Rousey's out for 6 months now, the UFC. Yeah.
And you know what? There was a lot of criticism about that fight that she was left on the ground.
She didn't hit her, though, when she went down. She did try to hit her, but she didn't make contact. But I agree. I think the ref should have just stopped jumped straight on top. Yeah.
Well, that's where I suppose I've spoke up against the UFC type style before, because I don't agree with that. And I've said to you before that that is where we might see a casualty or fatality yet.
Listen, you have a quarterfinal to get ready for this Saturday night in the National Stadium. If anyone wants to go along and see, the women's finals are taking place on Friday night. Katie Taylor is going to fight her first ever senior international final. It's amazing. Four walkovers and finally she gets to have a fight.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's up against Sean O'Keefe from Clonmel in the lightweight division, 60 kgs. So she hasn't fought since her European Games final. No. But for yourself, you're fighting the quarterfinals. Stephen Lawrence, do you know much about him?
No, I've watched him this year. Earlier in the year, he boxed one of my club mates and beat him. But look, I'm quite confident. He's just breaking into senior level. He won intermediates earlier this year, so he'll be looking to transition and keep up his success. But I'm hoping my experience and skills will be enough to get me through.
Yeah, and he did a few rounds with Dean Gardner there recently.
I did,
it's good preparation.
That's two or three weekends now. We've had some good tear ups. And Dean obviously is a good bit bigger than me. He's 105 or whatever it is, kilos.
He's a monster.
Yeah. But we have a good tear up, you know, and it's great. And I got some midweek sparring last week with Tony Brown and Sean Allen, two light heavyweights. So, you know, a good variety. And looking forward to it. I think Friday night will be a very good night boxing as well for the females. Another very
I just saw Michaela Walsh
fight.
Stepping down to bantamweight to fight Kira.
I think this is going to be a massive fight.
Huge,
you know?
Fight.
We've got three Olympic weights for the female boxing. We have 51 kilos, 60 kilos, which is obviously Katie, and 75 kilos. Now, 75 kilos is a walkover for Christina Desmond of Cork, who moved up from 69 last year. But the 51 between Kira and Michaela is going to be a fantastic fight. You know, Michaela Walsh is a Belfast girl who won silver at the Commonwealth Games last year. And Kira Smith, obviously, we know was at the European Games this year. And only recently beat the world champion. So it's going to be a fantastic fight. You know, and obviously it's finals night for the girls. So this is the
get down
here.
Get down to National Stadium on Friday night or Saturday, particularly Friday for the women's finals. And obviously, if you want to see Darren do the business on Saturday. Look, my thanks to both of you for coming in. You might come back next week and tell us how you got on.
Yeah, definitely. Some interesting fights over the next few weeks. Obviously, quarterfinals this week, but the semifinals.
Davey and Huey Oliver Joyce, what's going to happen there? Come on.
Yeah, look,
are they going to fight?
I don't see
Butters
it.
Going head to head.
They might have the fight at home before they get to the stadium.
Tell you what, a ton more and whoever comes through.
Yeah. But look, good weekends ahead.
Absolutely, and we're going to talk more about it next week. My thanks to Darren and to Gary for coming in tonight.